This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. My name is Kev Lotchen, and I'm joined today by news editor Elizabeth Pearson.
Hello.
Editor assistant Ian Todd.
Hello.
And for the first time, editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
Very deep there, Chris. So, it feels like these are getting closer and closer together.
Yes. But it's fine.
All the science it's is happening. Yes. We've actually got a lot to talk about, so we're going to crack straight on. Coming up later in the show, we are going to be playing News Bingo. We're going to hear from the Sky Night TV show's Pete Lawrence with some more practical observing advice. And Ian, you've done this month's interview. All I've got in my notes is it's Beth Healy, a doctor who worked for ESA in Antarctica.
That's right. I mean, should I introduce it now? Do you want me to let you know now, or do you want me to keep you in suspense until later on?
Give me a little bit of self.
Well, yeah, Beth Healy is basically a medical doctor who's been working for ESA in the Antarctica, carrying out research to basically prepare for future missions to Mars, seeing how harsh environments and isolation, the effect that has on the human body and mind.
Awesome. We'll find out more about that a bit later on. But first, we'll jump straight into the news, and possibly the biggest story this month is Juno has finally reached Jupiter.
Yay!
Juno.
After, what was it, 5 years it's been, roughly?
I think it was a little bit shy, but yeah.
Launched in 2011,
didn't it? Yeah.
3 billion kilometres, I think, was the total journey distance.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a pretty long haul.
Yeah. It had like a flyby around Earth in 2013, which I assume was one of those flybys to kind of...
Pick up speed.
Yes, it was.
Gravity assist. Yes. That's what we call it in the business.
Yes.
So Juno's there. It's going to stay for around 20 months, 37 right. orbits.
Yes, yeah. Hopefully.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Well, it's because the reason why that it has to do these like huge looping orbits because of Jupiter's radiation.
Which is a little bit murderous.
Just a little bit. Yeah. Just a little bit. There's a reason we've only sent 2 probes to Jupiter, I think. Voyager and Galileo.
Because they get fried.
Yes, because they get fried.
Does Voyager count? Because that was only really a flyby.
It counts. But yes, yeah, so it's 37 is what they're aiming for and what they reckon they can get out of it, yes.
But Galileo, when it was there, it found that there was that little gap between the kind of radiation belts of Jupiter and the planet itself. So it's going to be zipping through those. So
yes.
Hopefully, it's not going to break too quickly.
Yes, they've spent a lot of time and a lot of effort to make sure that it doesn't just immediately die, because that would be bad.
They've encased all the really delicate, most delicate instruments in a titanium box, basically.
Yeah.
To protect it all from the kind of...
Is titanium kind of radiation reducing? I mean, you know, it's lead.
Lead's a bit heavy.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I seem to remember they said with the radiation... I think they call it the radiation vault.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
Which has all of the electronics in. It was basically, that's one of the few times when you don't skimp because of weight. make sure that the radiation is not going to get through.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what they're doing now until October. I think like official science collection doesn't start until October of this year. But they're already kind of carrying out research about its magnetosphere. I think it was Scott Bolton, the principal investigator, had kind of said that actually he said something quite funny because it reached orbit on the 4th of July, and he said it was the first ever 4th of July he'd spent in a windowless room. Because it's Independence Day, obviously, in America.
Yeah.
But he didn't mind. He said it was worth it.
Worth it for the science.
Yeah, it is, yes. Yeah.
So it's going to be measuring Jupiter's gravity and magnetic fields. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it's going to try and establish what it's made of as well, a composition of the stuff below the clouds.
Yes, it's basically going to be the first mission to really try to get to grips with what's going on. But I think we can see about 100 kilometres down into Jupiter's gas layer at the moment. And this will be hopefully going right down into the core and seeing what's going on there.
Do we have any sensible ideas about what that core is already? Is it all conjecture?
There's quite a few options. I think the one that generally is the most support behind it is an iron core around which, because it's got this huge magnetic field, so there must be something creating the magnetic field.
Sure.
And the way that we know mostly is an iron core. There have been some various weird ideas by things like metallic hydrogen, which is when you get hydrogen under a lot of pressure and at really high temperatures, it starts acting a bit weird, as things do under lots of pressure and temperature, and acts more like a metal than a gas.
But it's also a liquid.
That's
just weird, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So basically they need to work out, is it a solid core? Is it a liquid core? What the heck's going on there?
Is it a magic eight ball?
There you go.
Do you know, so the other thing that's going to be doing, Juno is going to be looping over the poles.
Yes.
As well. So it's going to be able to check out the Jovian Aurorae.
Yes, that's one of the big things they're looking at.
So just before we kind of came on, Hubble have published the Hubble Space Telescope. The scientists behind the Hubble Space Telescope have published a new photo of Jupiter's Aurorae, and they're astounding. Mm. They are so strong, and they're massive.
Mm. They're huge, aren't they? They're about 1,000 times bigger than displays on Earth, aren't they?
They are, however, generally, if you went to Jupiter to try and go in and see the aurora, you might be a bit disappointed because they tend to be in the ultraviolet, so you won't see anything.
But
I know. If you took a tourist trip to Jupiter.
Have you also been keeping up with GenoCam as well? That was the other thing I wanted to bring up about Juno.
That's the one that's with all the connections with the amateur astronomers.
Yeah, it's the visible camera. But NASA are using amateur info to pick targets for the GenoCam later on the mission when it goes from its kind of high orbit at the moment. I think it's 50 days it takes at the moment, roughly, and when it goes to the 14-day science orbits. But right now, you can submit telescope images to NASA, and right now you can look at them and kind of click on those images and kind of like, oh, that looks interesting, go look at this.
Yeah. I mean, the debate's open, and this is kind of, it's very interesting the way that they're crowdsourcing the... you know, they're kind of targets like that.
And I was looking at it earlier, there's quite a lively discussion going on.
It's very active, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very active,
I just really love the fact that they've got, like, this billion-dollar telescope, and they've got all of these other, like, massive observatories and stuff, and actually the best ones for observing the planets are quite often people in their back gardens with their equipment that they just use because they love the astronomy.
It's fantastic, really good, and it just shows, there is a place for people like that, astronomers, in the kind of cutting edge science, which is really, really exciting.
Mm. But speaking about the JunoCam, what are the images that we're going to get back from Jupiter going to be like? Because we've kind of been spoiled over the past few years, images of Ceres and Saturn and Mars, but are we going to get anything that detailed, that kind of crisp and clear?
I think we are.
Yeah, JunoCam is going to be doing, because it's going to be getting right up close and personal with Jupiter, and JunoCam will get some images from that. The kind of really big scientific data that they're trying to get with Juno is going to be things like a gravitational map of the planet and a magnetic map of the planet, which are incredibly, incredibly important if you're a scientist, but are not going to be, you know, beautiful pictures like you'd get from Hubble. Hopefully there'll be some cool shots of the aurora, though, even if it is in the UV.
But they will be able to kind of transpose that data to a presentable format that makes sense to non-scientists. Mm-hmm. You don't need to have a PhD to kind of make sense of a spreadsheet or whatever.
Because
they do that quite regularly, don't they? With kind of false color maps and things like that. So yeah. I think we're in for some treats when the science starts coming in October. Yeah.
Hopefully we'll start be able to get sort of some structural diagrams of what it's actually like if you cut a slice through Jupiter, what would we look like?
And what about the Great Red Spot as well? You know, but potentially.
Yeah, that's one of the big targets.
Yeah, I might find out why it's shrinking.
Exactly.
Why it sometimes goes a bit grey.
Yes.
It's great and why it's red, which are two of the biggest problems, mysteries with the Great Red Spot.
So many questions. So we should probably move on. I've got some more for you.
Is it that time again?
It's that time again. It's time for News Bingo. Yay. So
I feel like there should be a jingle. I'm not going to make one up.
Please do. Please bring a little Christmas jingle bell. I'm totally doing that next time. Right, so News Bingo is where I'm going to read you out a handful of questions I got through this month based on recent astronomical news stories. And you have to guess what the big news I'm talking about is. Now, you've kind of won a piece. Chris, this is your first one. How are you feeling?
Clock, knuckles, come on. Warm up.
although Ian's anyone who's got a perfect run.
Was that last time? You got a perfect score last time.
3 out of 3.
No pressure.
Super pressure. Yeah. So let's get straight on it. So, first one. What will Mars gain in the distant future that recent research suggests it has lost once already?
Okay.
And these are all new stories that have come up in the past month, and more than likely, you've seen them.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Right. So you have pads in front of you, of course, so you can write this down without shouting it out and spoiling everyone else. So please play along at home. Right, I see pens have stopped scratching. Hit me.
Rings?
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Rings, is it? I thought it was a magnetic field.
So they're kind of, one of two main theories as to how Mars got its two moons. One is that it kind of captured a passing asteroid, and the other is that a massive impact created a ring of debris, which eventually resulted in Phobos and Deimos, the two moons, and because they're spiraling inward, they might crash land on Mars and create rings again.
Yeah, that's basically it, yeah. So these two hypotheses have been knocking around for a while, and so Phobos, the larger of the two, is spiraling towards the red planet and will eventually be torn asunder by these tidal forces. That's where the later ring will come from. The reason we've suddenly thought that it might have lost a ring as opposed to being captured is a new simulation. And it's to do with how fast Mars was spinning when the moons are formed. So for Earth, because this is a big stumbling block that both Earth and Mars, if Mars had the kind of impact model, why has it got those two moons that are both so weird when we've got one? And it's to do with rotational speed. So these researchers said the Earth was spinning so fast at the point where we got our moon that a single day was 4 hours, which is not enough time to sleep, quite frankly. And so it just had the effect that our moon kind of got pushed out far enough away that it became totally locked. But Mars is spinning much slower, so its ring coalescing the Phobos and several smaller moons. Now, in time, all those small moons have disappeared. They've, you know, I assume crashed into the planet. Phobos is just the one in the future will do so. Deimos, this is why I said you kind of had it right, won't actually crash into the planet.
Okay.
It's too far away. It's eventually going to spin off and like be a kind of a sailor amongst the stars.
Well, so it just turned into, back into a large asteroid.
Do I remember reading that there was signs of stress on Phobos, which it basically looked like it was on the cusp of falling apart.
Is Phobos
on the cusp being, you know, several thousand years?
Phobos is the one, if I'm, this is what we're thinking of, where it's got stress fractures, so they think it might be a kind of a, like a hollow shell, kind of including a bunch of rubble, and then
it's kind of all a bit.
It's a jangly bag of marbles.
Yeah, it's held together with hope and gravity.
Right. So that was just one for you, wasn't it, Ian?
Yeah.
Well done.
Ooh, it's a good start. He's on his winning run again. Right. So second one. What have astronomers discovered in the last month that suggests that planets in habitable zones could be less habitable than we once thought?
Okay.
And think within the solar system, just to kind of give you an angle. I can see what Ez is writing. She's straight on it. And in fact, she's writing an essay.
I wrote six words.
Your pen is very scratchy. Ian's stuck.
Yeah, I'm stuck.
Chris?
Stumped.
I said, I've written down superheated atmospheres. I don't really know whether that was discovered in the past month.
Let's go for it.
I think they discovered a really, really really strong electric field around Venus.
Absolutely.
And that was basically stripping out all of the oxygen from the atmosphere.
Yes.
And they think that's one of the reasons why Venus ended up the wonderful, lovely hothouse that it is today.
Absolutely. I mean, the solar wind can do that as well. And they thought it was the solar wind that was kind of eroding the rest of the oxygen atoms away. But, and this is from Glenn Collinson of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, who says, "We never dreamt an electric wind could be so powerful. We don't know why it is so much stronger at Venus than Earth. But we think it might have something to do with Venus being closer to the sun and the ultraviolet sunlight being twice as bright." And he kind of basically goes on to infer that even if the planet's in a habitable zone, we expect that water might exist. It could depend on the star that changes how much oxygen the planet can retain.
Yeah, it's sort of, as time goes on and we get a slightly better idea of how planetary systems and atmospheres work, it does seem that that habitable zone is shrinking a little bit. But, it seems like there's going to be a lot of things that we have to consider before we send off a probe to Earth 2.0.
If we can find Earth 2.0.
If we can find Earth 2.0.
What have we found, like, anything that's vaguely close that we can say with any surety? Things that look right, but things that we can say with surety?
The big problem with the Earth 2.0 thing is it's really hard to find things that are that size and at that distance because it's too far away really to do transiting. It's too small to do transiting. Doesn't make the star wobble enough. And so they're getting better and kind of like narrowing in on those. But yeah, at the moment, we're a bit tricky to see.
Cool. All right. So, and finally, a question, which isn't quite as off base as the last two. Who or what is RR245?
Sorry, what? R2405?
RR245.
Why do astronomers incapable of naming things?
Because, I don't know, it would end up being
either. Because there's about 7 million things to name, that's why.
Too many things. Running out of mythology. Risk of Rocky McRocky Face.
Is that the moon of Planet E McPlanet Face?
Quite so.
245.
I can't believe this has stumped you all so much.
Yeah.
Right, we best crack on because there's an awkward period of science.
Yes, okay.
I remembered that name, and I can't work out whether or not my answer is correct, but is it the newly discovered candidate for a new dwarf planet in the Kuiper Belt?
It is.
Very good.
So this is our new celebrity, the latest member of the solar system, as you said, a dwarf planet in the Kuiper Belt. Do you know anything about it more? Look how quickly knowledge comes in and out. It's 700 kilometres in diameter on a massive elliptical orbit, which takes about, coincidentally, 700 years.
That's right, yeah.
And that takes it 120 times farther out from the sun than Earth is, but will eventually bring it within 34 AU, which is inside the mean orbit of Pluto. And it's coming towards us, so it should reach perihelion in 2096. So our views of it, hopefully, are only going to get better and find out what it is. But this is like one of the things that was dug up out of the Outer Solar System's Origin Survey, which has been taken in Mauna Kea and Hawaii. And it's the first time they found the dwarf planet. And they've done like 500 objects plus in the Kuiper Belt, because you're never going to find all the objects in the Kuiper Belt. Yeah. Well, maybe we will, but there's so many.
Yeah.
But this is the first one that's dwarf planet size. Although, they don't know quite so much about it. I mean, there's a quote from Michelle Bannister from the University of Victoria in British Columbia, who worked on the study, and she said, "It's either small and bright or large and dull." So
one or the other.
There was actually a bonus point in this. I thought RR245, someone might think it was a droid from the Star Wars.
I did put Mars drone because I thought it might be some reference to that, but no, okay, carry on.
That's a really low scoring thing because there's only three this month, so it's a tie.
It was hard.
A tie?
It's a tie between Ian and Ez.
No beginner's luck for me.
One each. Next time, Chris.
Yes, next time.
I thought Ian got two.
Yeah, he got two, Kev.
Did you get two?
Mars's rings and the dwarf planet.
Oh, sorry, you're quite right. It is Ian, you did
win. As much as I hate to concede defeat.
Thanks very much,
Ian. He did beat me.
Okay, so
I'll
2-1
to Ian. I'll get you next time, Todd.
Right, we best move on to something a bit more practical. Here is Pete Lawrence from the Sky Night TV show, who's going to be telling us how you can see the Perseid meteor shower this month.
The Perseid meteor shower is probably one of the most popular meteor showers of the year. And the reason for this is that at its peak, it shows a good number of meteor streaks. And also, it occurs at a time of the year when it's reasonably warm. Well, as warm as a British summer can ever get. Now, to observe it, you don't need any specialist equipment at all, just your eyes and preferably something to make you comfortable outside, like a sun lounger or a deck chair or something which will allow you to look up at a height of about 60 degrees in the sky, where you can lie down for an extended period of time and just take in the view. You need to find a location which is away from any stray lights. And before you actually do your main meteor watch, you need to be outside for at least 20 minutes in darkness to allow your eyes to properly dark adapt. Once you're ready, then look up, as I say, at about 60 degrees, two-thirds of the way up the sky. The direction doesn't really matter. Meteor streaks can occur anywhere. But the common advice is to look about 40 to 60 degrees either side of the meteor radiant. Now, my recommendation would be to look somewhere to the east, round to the south on the nights around the maximum activity. And this year, maximum occurs on the 12th of August. Actually, it occurs during the day or the expectation is that it's going to occur during the day. So the best nights to look for Perseid activity will be the 11th, 12th and the 12th, 13th. But the shower is actually active from the 23rd of July through to the 23rd of August. So you could see a meteor associated with the Perseid meteor stream at any time along those dates, or between those dates. Now, the meteor shower itself itself should go up to what's known as the zenithal hourly rate of about 150 meteors per hour. That's the prediction for this year. But that doesn't mean that's how many meteors you're going to see. The zenithal hourly rate, or ZHR, is the normalized optimum rate that you can see. If you could see the entire sky in one go, the sky was perfectly clear, and the radiant, the point where the meteors associated with the shower appear to come from, was directly overhead. Now, we're unlikely to be able to satisfy any of those criteria, so the actual visual rate will be much lower, typically somewhere between 20 to 50 meteors per hour. But that's still a good number of meteors to spot. If you see a streak rushing across the sky, don't assume it's going to be a Perseid. It could belong to another shower, or it could be a random meteor known as a sporadic meteor. To qualify as a Perseid, you need to trace the trail back, and the trail needs to go through the meteor radiant. If that doesn't happen, it's not a Perseid meteor. What time should you observe? Well, typically, the best time to observe is from midnight universal time through to dawn, so 1 a.m. BST through to dawn. That's because the Earth will have turned, so we're hitting the meteoroids head on and we get brighter collisions, so we should be able to see those meteors much clearer. So good luck with your meteor watch this year, and fingers crossed that we get some spectacular Perseid meteors.
There's been a lot of talk over the past few years about humans travelling to Mars, but one of the problems, I suppose, is that we still aren't sure the effect that such a long journey would have on the human body and mind. So for this episode, I was speaking to Dr. Beth Healy, who's a medical doctor, who spent a year in Antarctica at the Concordia Research Station working for ESA. And basically, her purpose was to see how the harsh environment affects human health and behaviour in preparation for potential future journeys to Mars. And I started off by asking her how she got involved in the mission.
I mean, I've worked as part of medical and logistical support teams for a number of expeditions and sort of endurance races, which got me really interested in working in extreme environments and also extreme environment physiology. When I was a medical student, I had the chance to go to the European Astronaut Centre as well and do a space medicine course with ESA. So I knew that I was really interested in space medicine. And so when the opportunity for the job in Antarctica came up, I just really jumped at the chance.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the purpose of the mission? How was it kind of sold to you?
The purpose of the mission is to look at the effects of the isolation on the crew. So you're looking towards long duration space flight missions. Because in Antarctica, during the long polar winter, you've got 9 months where the crew are completely isolated. And so we're looking at the effects of that in terms of the physiology and psychology of the crew.
Mm. So was that solely it? It was kind of the psychological aspects? I mean, how did you measure this? How did you actually carry out your research?
Well, there's lots of reasons why Concordia is a great platform for space research, and it's not just the isolation. So the isolation is the one thing that Concordia really does have compared to other environments which we use for the research. But it also has lots of other aspects. So, for example, we've got the sort of 100 days where you don't see the sunlight. So we look at the effects of that on the crew, and use of artificial lighting for long periods of time as well. You're also at altitude at Concordia, so you've got chronic low-level hypoxia. It's also an international base, so you've got an international crew working there with lots of different languages, as you would on a space station. And so there's lots of different similarities between living on a base like Concordia and also going on a long-duration space flight mission.
Hmm. So what was your daily routine like?
So from day to day, it was quite varied. So the experiments that we were doing, sometimes they were more busy than others. So we had different points throughout the winter where there was a lot more data collection. But on a day-to-day basis, I would spend sort of around lunchtime in my lab. The crew would come on a daily basis to have some measurements taken. And so that was the main part of my day. But of course, we were doing analysis and data transfer in the afternoons. And there's lots of other roles as well as working on the ESA research. So every crew member on the base gets involved with all sorts of different aspects of crew life. So whether it's from cooking to cleaning to helping move snow and all those different things. We're also part of lots of different teams, so you learn how to be part of a fire team and vice versa. Other people are taught how to be part of a medical rescue team. So it really is quite a busy time to be at Concordia.
Mm. So how many people were in your team, including you?
We were a crew of 13 people, and it's about a 50-50 split between scientific and technical staff.
Okay. So did you kind of have to see them on a regular basis in order to kind of carry out the measurements and you know, analyze how they were coping within the situations?
Yeah, absolutely. Generally, people come to the lab once a week to take measurements, but there were certain times through the overwinter period where we were doing a lot more research than that, so we'd take a lot more data. But these were just at set points throughout the mission. But we're collecting data all the time. So to give you an example, we're wearing activity watches, and these not only measured sort of our general activity measurements, but also our sleep-wake cycle. And they also actually interacted with different members of the crew. So to give you an example, my watch would interact with your watch, and it would let us know how much time we're spending together and where we're spending that time. And the idea of that is that we can look to see where people are spending their time, so if they're choosing to be in social or more isolated environments, and really critical time points in the mission where crew are more likely to be isolating themselves. And also looked at crew dynamics and how that was changing, the formation of subgroups and any sort of big arguments or splits within the group during the winter time.
Just talking about isolation there, I mean, was that a worry for you whenever you were offered the post? You must have had a few kind of doubts and fears about the prospect of spending time in such an isolated place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, that was the biggest worry before going down there. And I think it probably was for most people. And we did lots of training before we went to help us prepare for that. So as a crew, we went to the European Astronaut Centre and had what they call human behaviour and performance training. And that was aimed at preparing the crew psychologically for that kind of pressure so that we could work together well as a team. So it's all sort of team behaviour training. But yeah, certainly knowing that you're going to be isolated like that does make you worry a bit.
So what were your biggest challenges when you were actually living there?
Of course, it's sort of missing home, missing friends, family, avocado, things like mango as well. It's kind of also, actually, Concordia has a water recycling system. It's actually one of the prototypes for the one that we use on the International Space Station. And so we have to use certain products in the shower. So you weren't allowed to have shampoo or conditioner for an entire year, which was a bit of a struggle. So there's lots of things. I guess the biggest thing for me was the long polar night. So when we had 100 days without seeing the sunlight. And I think probably the anticipation of that was worse than the actual reality. So when I first went down to Concordia, I heard all these sort of horrendous stories about what was going to happen to us as a crew when we lost the sun. And fortunately, not many of them came true. But I think it was that period and sort of the anticipation of what it was going to be like down there.
But now that the emission has ended, you must still be carrying on analysing the data and doing work that's relevant to your mission. How has your work continued since coming back to Europe, and also how will your research actually be used by ESA?
Well, this is a really exciting time for us. So a lot of the data is only just getting back into Europe at the moment. So it's a long journey for all the samples and everything to come back, and they've arrived quite a bit later than me. So it's really going to be quite a busy time now with all the different teams analysing the different data sets, and really, really quite exciting. In terms of our crew, we've just been at the European Astronaut Centre and we had the sort of final post-mission measurements taken to see how we've sort of re-acclimatised being back in sort of the real world as it is. So that was, yeah, just a few weeks ago that we were doing that, and that was really sort of the end of the mission for us as a crew. And then over the next few months, and in some cases years, because some of the experiments which I was doing are going to have been carried on this year at Concordia, so we're sort of waiting for some of their data. So they'll be published over the next couple of years. So really excited to see what we find.
Will you continue working with ESA for the foreseeable future, or was this has your work with ESA come to
yes.
an end?
So for the moment, after the mission, that's sort of officially the end of my time working with ESA, although this summer we're sort of doing an outreach tour called White Space, which is going to events and shows and conferences this summer. So I'm doing that, and then after that I'm not quite sure.
But you'll still be able to keep an eye on the International Space Station, and hopefully maybe you'll recognise some signs of your work actually being implemented?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really exciting. One of the experiments that we were doing, it was a cognition test, which they were also doing up on the International Space Station at the same time. So that was all in the research phase, is now actually going to be implemented into normal astronaut routine in just a couple of months. So already we start to see things happening, which is a result of the research that we were doing down there, which is really exciting. And a lot of the research as well, it's not just going to benefit astronauts. So, for example, looking at the effects of use of artificial light on eyesight benefits a wide range of people. For example, people working in factories or on night shifts where they're subjected to similar conditions too.
Brilliant. Well, Ed, it must be very, very rewarding to see all your hard work finally paying off. But yeah, thanks very much for talking to me, Beth. It's been really interesting hearing about your exploits.
Oh, no problem. It's been a pleasure.
Right, we should probably tell you what's coming up in the next issue of BBC Sky Night magazine. We're going to be revisiting past missions to Venus and exploring the ones already been planned for the future. Because it's summer, not that you might be able to tell given the weather we're having at the moment, we're going to be talking about how to image the sun in three wavelengths, in white light, in hydrogen alpha, which has a kind of ruddy hue, and in calcium K, which shows up purple. On the same theme, we've got a guide to different types of astronomical filters used for observing, and we review a standalone CCD camera. Now, did any of you actually see that when it came into the office?
I had a look at it, yeah.
It's a thing of beauty, isn't it? But this comes with an optional touchscreen, and it works control applications are internal. So actually,
you don't need a computer.
Yeah.
You don't need a laptop with it. It really frees you up for travel.
It's an interesting proposition. Pete Lawrence reviews that for us in this issue. Also, and in the print edition, we've got a series of free postcards to accompany our feature on the future of solar system adventure holidays.
Mm.
Now, if you could go anywhere in the solar system on adventure holiday, where would you go?
Triton.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Cryovolcanoes. It's like volcanoes, but cold. And then it's like, because I like the cold and I like snow. Admittedly, probably not the minus however many hundred it is on Triton, but still.
I'm really impressed because I figured the first thing out of someone's mouth was going to be Saturn. Because of rings and that wow factor for when you look through a telescope.
Yeah.
I thought that might be a sharp one.
If it was possible, I'd like to go to Mars and hang out with Curiosity.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
I'm not sure he'd be much fun, but we could just walk along.
Did you see Short Circuit as a child? And then you go, oh, I know. Oh, it'd be really great.
What, is that not like that?
Well, Curiosity is one of those ones. In fact, most of the Mars rovers, they do have that sort of very anthropomorphic thing because they tend to have like a camera which looks like a big head and it's looking around. And yeah, they do always look quite friendly. A bit Wall-E.
Yes, I was going to say, it looks exactly like Wall-E, doesn't it?
Could a Short Circuit / Wall-E type robot actually get around on Mars with those kind of triangular treads? I don't know if Wall-E has triangular treads, actually. Short Circuit definitely did.
Yeah, no, most rovers have some sort of treads because that's how you get around.
Curiosity has wheels, doesn't it?
Curiosity does have wheels, you are quite right.
What about you, Chris? You're remarkably quiet.
I was just thinking where to go. Out of all the wonderful places out there in the solar system, I'd like to go to Enceladus, actually.
Ooh.
Is that because of the prospects of life out there?
And also the tiger stripes and the strange kind of plumes of material.
It is.
Gently escaping the crust.
It is
or the
a
icy
one.
Crust of the planet.
Excellent. Ian, I mentioned very briefly the Venus feature, and that ties into our bonus content this month, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. This month I managed to speak to Dr. James Green, who's the Director of Planetary Sciences at NASA, just basically kind of getting a rundown. We're discussing the past, present, and future of Venus exploration, what NASA's got in store in the future for returning to the planet, and we discussed a bit about kind of past missions and what we've learned.
Excellent. Right then. BBC Sky Night Magazine is available in print and in several digital formats. Find out more at skynightmagazine.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store. This has been Radio Astronomy. We have been BBC Sky Night Magazine, and we'll be back in a month's time.